Well, it is a great pleasure to be here. I know that that's standard boilerplate. Speakers always say things like that, but sometimes it is really true, and it is in this case. At least it will be if I can figure out how to get my watch here so that I neither forget it and walk off with it, but can still see it. It is. Am I turned on? Okay. Yes, that's good. It's also a pleasure to see a lot of students here. I wish I could pretend to myself that you were all here because the topic, you saw that posted someplace on campus and thought, I've just got to hear about natural law. I understand that you're not, but I hope it'll be fun to you anyway. For those of you who are students, I should say something else, though. See, I had expected that this was going to be mostly faculty here this afternoon, and I'll be giving a more popular level talk tonight. This was going to be the one which is more at the level of practicing scholars, and there are some things that you may not be used to. For instance, but on the other hand, it may be things that that you can understand. You know that a literature scholar, for instance, may spend 45 minutes just talking about the meaning of one crucial sentence in Moby Dick. Or if you are in a seminary or studying theology or religious studies, you may have somebody giving a couple of class sessions just to explaining one verse in Christian scripture, or for that matter, in the writings of the Buddha, or something like that. Well, much of what I'm saying today is going to be an explication of one sentence in the works of a very smart guy named Thomas Aquinas, who wrote in the Middle Ages about natural law, not because everything that he said was correct, but because it's a sentence that's highly charged with meaning and is very interesting to investigate. So it's a way of opening a door into the topic. May not be one that you're used to, but, you know, scholars do this kind of thing. The title of the talk is Playing Dumb, The Natural Consequences of the Natural Law, as you know. Thank you very much for that water. With a title like that, I think I'd better begin by explaining what I'm talking about, what the natural law is. Natural law means the foundational principles of right and wrong, along with their first few rungs of implications. And when we say natural law, well, there's an adjective there, natural. There's a noun there that is law. They are law because they really are binding. Natural because they are built into the design of human nature, woven into the fabric of the normal adult mind. You just got a couple of points for Professor Stoner's quiz. Because they are law, and because we don't make them up, they also stand in judgment on all merely human, merely man-made law. Now, it isn't my purpose in this talk to show that there really is such a thing as a natural law. I've done that in other places. And just for this talk, I'm taking it for granted. Now, please feel completely free to tell me during the Q&A that there is no natural law, for of course, I do recognize that this is controversial. Once upon a time, it wasn't so controversial. It was possible for a thinker to write that the foundational principles are, quote-unquote, the same for all, both as to rectitude and as to knowledge. What the heck does that mean? Well, I will explain. But he could say this and expect everyone to agree. To say that these foundational principles are the same for all as to rectitude means that they're right for everyone. In other words, deliberately taking innocent human life, sleeping with my neighbor's wife, mocking God are as wrong for me as they are for you, no matter what either one of us believes. To say that they are the same for all as to knowledge, that was the other part of the expression, means that at some level everyone really knows them. At some level everyone really knows them. Even the murderer knows the wrong of murder. Even the adulterer knows the wrong of sleeping with his neighbor's wife. Even the mocker knows the wrong of mocking God. He may say that he doesn't, but he really does, deep down. From this point of view, there are no real moral skeptics. Those who are supposed skeptics are playing make-believe and usually doing it badly. Now, as I say, once upon a time, a thinker who wrote such words could expect nearly everyone to agree, and nearly everyone did. The Christians agreed, the Jews agreed, the Muslims agreed, and moreover, they could call to their support the consensus of the rest of the human race. You might search the wide world over for a people somewhere who didn't know the moral basics, but you would fail. Now, to be sure, the wide world over, people also carved out excuses for themselves. I must not take innocent human life. Yeah, but only my tribe is human. I must not sleep with my neighbor's wife. Yes, but I can make her my wife. I must not mock deity. But I can ascribe deity to a thing that I made with my own hands instead of to the Creator. And so not only was moral knowledge universal, but there was something else that was universal too. The desire to evade moral knowledge was universal. There are two universals, not just one, you see. The moral law and the determination to play tricks on moral knowledge. You might say, a law was written on the heart of man. But it was everywhere entangled with the evasions and subterfuges of men. And even so, that law endured. And even so, it was seen to endure. Now, I happen to believe that this is not merely an outmoded way of thinking, but actually corresponds to reality. In fact, natural law theory is experiencing an intellectual renaissance, and I am glad to be a small part of that. And I suppose that's why I think that I can get away with giving you a talk that works within the natural law framework rather than standing outside of it and merely discussing the controversy. No, this is a talk by a natural lawyer. I'm speaking within the tradition. But what do I mean? So that's natural law. Natural law, the title of the talk, remember, was Playing Dumb, the Natural Consequences of Violating the Natural Law. But what do I mean by the second part of that title? The Natural Consequences of Violating the Natural Law. The great medieval natural law thinker Thomas Aquinas, to whom I have already alluded, described law as a kind of discipline that compels through fear of punishment. He described law as a kind of discipline that compels through fear of punishment, and I use that remark as my point of departure. As I mentioned before, that's another thing that political and ethical theorists do. In natural law, our theoretical tradition is a live tradition. It isn't a dead one. It is still developing. The discussion is still going on. But the tradition is also a very old one, and some of our discussions that are still going on have been going on for centuries. So that you may be speaking at one moment to your contemporaries, but at another moment you may be speaking with, so to speak, people who lived 8 centuries before you. And that's what I'm doing today. Now, Thomas Aquinas offers his comment that law is a kind of discipline that compels through fear of punishment. He offers that comment in the context of a discussion of human law, man-made law, the kind of thing that emerges from the Congress of the United States or the legislature of the great state of Louisiana or something like that. And so far as human law goes, I suppose the meaning of his comment is clear, right? There are consequences to violating the human law. There are human-imposed consequences to violating the human law. If I drive on the left side of the road instead of the right, for instance, which is against the human law, well, the legislator attaches certain penalties to the categories of acts that he doesn't want done. I may be pulled over and made to pay a fine. If I do so frequently, I may be required to take a defensive driving course or a driving safety course. For continuing to drive on the left side of the road, even then, I may forfeit my license to drive. That's another consequence. For driving without a license, I may suffer the impoundment of my vehicle. They take it away from me. And for driving very fast to escape the policeman, so that my vehicle won't be taken away, I may be sentenced to time in prison. Presumably, that's the sort of thing that Thomas Aquinas had in mind when he said, law is a kind of discipline that compels through fear of punishment, and we think, ho-hum, yes, we all know that, let's now go to sleep. That is a trivial example, but I'd like you to notice 3 things about it that are not trivial at all, and that are the gateway into some things that are not at all ho-hum. First, the civil penalty isn't the reason that the act is wrong. If a man holds back from stealing his neighbor's car only because he's afraid of serving time, we consider him base. There is something wrong with his motivations. Rather, what the civil penalty does is it instructs him that the act is wrong, and it provides a further motive, if he needs one, over and above its sheer wrongness, for avoiding it. The reason the act is wrong is first that it's contrary to the common good. And second, that it's been recognized and declared to be such by public authority. Now, that declaration, by the way, not only announces what's needed for the common good, but to a certain degree it, quote-unquote, determines it. Determination is a technical term in the natural law theory, and so I need to talk about that. This is, in fact, the second interesting thing about the example, that declaration by public authority not only announces what's needed for the common good, but in a certain way it determines it. What determination means, the technical term, is what I call filling in the details, pinning down the details or filling in the blanks. You see, it isn't in itself contrary to the common good for me to drive on the left. No, it isn't in itself contrary to the common good for me to drive on the left. What's in itself contrary to the common good is for some people to be driving on the right while other people drive on the left. That's what's contrary to the common good, because they're all going to be colliding with each other and people are going to be hurt. Just to ensure that safety is preserved, that everybody drives on the same side of the road, it could have been the left, well, but you've got to decide something, the legislator commands that they all drive on the right. Driving on the left then becomes contrary to the common good through the declaration of the legislator, even though it wasn't contrary to the common good before. That's interesting that such a thing should be possible. The law is not without foundation, it's based on the common good. But until the law was passed, this wasn't contrary to the common good. How does that work? Well, this is determination. You're filling in the blanks. The legislator might have made driving on the right contrary to the common good, as legislators have done in England, but he didn't. He filled in the blanks. The third interesting, and I'll come back to that. I'm going to be coming back, as a matter of fact, to all three of these interesting things and saying what they have to do to the natural law. The third interesting thing about the example is that it reminds us that as a system of discipline, law is a form of a discipline that compels through fear of punishment. Remember, that's the line that I'm exegeting, that I'm elaborating, that I'm explaining. Well, okay, if law is a system of discipline, the third thing about this example is that it reminds us that as a system of discipline, penalties aren't perfectly efficient. They aren't a perfectly efficient form of discipline, nor is it likely that they could be so long as people have free will, which is a background condition that we have to assume. It's not just that people may seek to escape the penalties for wrongdoing. That's pretty obvious, I suppose. But there's more, and this part is maybe not so obvious. In order to escape the penalties, people may commit even greater wrongs, and so be subject to even greater penalties. Remember that man in my example who drives around the... He skids around the corner and he speeds even faster to escape the policeman who saw him driving on the wrong side of the road, and he does this, which is even worse, in order to escape the policeman so that his car won't be impounded. What that means is that paradoxically, up to a certain degree of corruption in the will of the individual who's subject to the law, the civil penalty discourages violation. You say, oh, you know, the lawmakers have said this is a bad thing to do, and they might make me pay a fine anyway, and I can sort of see that that's really right, and so I won't do it. But beyond that degree, beyond that point of corruption in the will, the penalty can actually be a motivation for doing worse. I just did wrong, and I knew did it on purpose. The policeman saw me. Now I've got to do an even greater wrong to get away from him. Okay? I was already driving on the wrong side of the road. Now I've got to do it at 185 miles an hour. Okay? A penalty giving you a motive for doing worse. Hold on to that thought. We'll come back to it. A penalty being a reason for violating the law. Let's go back to Thomas Aquinas. I said that he describes law as a kind of discipline that compels through fear of punishment. And I pointed out that he offers the comment in the context of a discussion of human law, and of course traffic laws are human laws, they're man-made laws. But it doesn't follow that his remark only applies to human law. He didn't say human law is a kind of discipline that compels through fear of punishment. He said law as such is a kind of discipline that compels through fear of punishment. And he applies the point to human law. Well, my suggestion is that the point can equally be applied, equally well be applied to the natural law, and that a great deal can be learned from the comparison. Just as there are civil penalties for breaking the human law, so there are natural penalties for breaking the natural law. Now let me explain that point before I go on. For breaking what Thomas Aquinas calls a general precept of the natural law, he distinguishes between general precepts and other precepts that are more detailed. For breaking what he calls a general precept of the natural law, one of those precepts that he says are, remember this line, the same for all, both as to knowledge and as to rectitude, one of those very general moral norms that is right for everybody and everybody knows it. Well, one penalty, one natural penalty for violating a law like that is a penalty in the knowledge, a penalty that happens to you in your intellect, it happens to you in your mind. What is the penalty? You have guilty knowledge. You know you were wrong. You know you were wrong. I'm not talking about how you feel. I'm not talking about feeling bad, but you know you were wrong. Some people say, well, the only such general principles that there are things that are so vague that they hardly seem to mean anything, like good is to be done and evil is to be avoided. Thomas Aquinas actually doesn't take that view. He speaks for the greater part of the natural law tradition when he says that it includes a lot of much more specific things than that. The general precepts include things like honor your father and mother, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal. He says these are matters which the natural reason of every man, of its own accord and at once, judges to be done or not done. As to the means by which the natural reason of every man makes these judgments, you might be thinking, well, the natural reason of every man makes these judgments, how does it do that? How does it do that? Well, as to the means by which we do it, we may disagree. But that it does do that seems certain. There's a difference between knowing that we know something and knowing how we know it. We may have different theories about how we know it, but it's much more certain that we do know it. And I think that that's the central point. Now, our knowledge of the derived principles, those are the general principles, but there are also much, much more detailed principles that are derived, like, here's an ancient one, rise up before the hoary head. Hoary, you know, means like frost. We're talking about people with white hair. Rise up before them and show respect to the aged. That's what that means. Well, our knowledge of principles like that is a little bit different. Those aren't things that you can't not know. Knowledge of such things may be weakened by neglect. They may be erased by culture. But our knowledge of the core principles, the wrong of deliberately taking innocent life, for instance, that is ineffaceable, ineradicable. It can't be wiped out of you. We may repress our knowledge of the core principles. We may hold it down. We may tell ourselves that we don't know what we really do know. But repressed knowledge is different than genuine ignorance. It's a very important point. And the effort to hold down the truth distorts the personality. That's a consequence, too. That's also a natural consequence. There are certain things, as I said before, that we can't not know. By the way, this is also the biblical view. I don't offer that comment as a philosophical proof, nor do I offer it to preach, but it's deeply important for understanding our Western civilization, shaped as it was, on the one hand, by Greek and Roman philosophical and legal traditions, and shaped, on the other hand, by Jewish and Christian scripture and revelatory tradition. In the first and second chapters of the book of Romans, St. Paul doesn't criticize the pagans because they don't know that there is a creator. He criticizes them because they repress their knowledge of the Creator. In other words, he doesn't say, those bad old pagans, they ought to know that there's a God, but they don't. No, he says those pagans, they do know, but they pretend to themselves that they don't. He says, what may be known about God is plain to them. The requirements of the law, he says this in one chapter following, are written on their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness. Nevertheless, he says, they hold the truth down. The Greek word is katakanton. In another translation, they suppress it. Well, being philosophy and not theology, natural law theory doesn't actually commit itself to a position on whether the Bible is true. An individual natural law thinker may do that. I do. I'm a Christian. Natural law theory as such does not. It's a philosophy. But I do think that natural law theory requires a creator, because otherwise the design of human conscience, which is what we're talking about, would be morally irrelevant. Conscience, if you acknowledge that there was such a thing at all, if there's no creator, would be merely the result of a meaningless and purposeless process that did not have us in mind. So I do think that natural law is committed to the reality of the Creator. But that's all a digression. I now end the digression and return to the trail of my argument. I was saying there are certain things that we can't not know, and I was connecting that up with some of the consequences, the natural consequences of violating the natural law. And the consequences that I was speaking of first were consequences in the mind, consequences in the intellect, bad things that happen to you up here, like guilty knowledge, when you violate the natural law. I've also been speaking of guilty knowledge as a natural penalty for breaking the general precepts of the natural law, but, you know, there are some other penalties too. And these penalties, by the way, are attached not only to the violation of the general principles, the ones you can't not know, but they're even attached to the violation of the more detailed precepts. And some of these further penalties show up within the lifetime of the individual. Some of them don't. They may not show up until a couple of generations have persisted in the same kinds of wrongdoing, but they accumulate. And sooner or later, they can no longer be ignored. Would an example be helpful? Let me offer you one. Here's a good one. It won't be politically correct, I'm afraid. The consequences, the natural consequences of violating the natural law precept that confines sexual intercourse to marriage. That has natural consequences. One immediate consequence of their violation is injury to the good of procreation. You might get pregnant but have nobody to help raise the child. That seems like a pretty serious consequence. Another immediate consequence is injury to the good of unity between the spouses. You miss the chance for that heightened personal intimacy which can develop only in a secure and exclusive relationship. There are long-term consequences too. One common consequence is poverty. Because single women have to provide for their children by themselves. And by the way, being in that situation correlates more strongly to poverty among women than any other single factor. Another is adolescent violence, because male children are growing up without a father's influence. That turns out to make a difference. Still other consequences, natural consequences, are venereal diseases, because formerly rare infections are spreading rapidly through sexual contact, child abuse, because live-in boyfriends often resent their girlfriend's babies, abortion, because children are increasingly regarded as a burden rather than as a joy. Sure, there are consequences. There are natural consequences for violating the natural law. People say, well, it isn't hurting anybody. Look at these things. I'd say it's hurting people quite a bit. Now, the longer that people persist in violating the natural law. This isn't a talk, by the way, about why sex ought to be confined to the marital relation. I'm just taking that for granted in order to explain the further point about natural consequences. Okay? The longer people persist in violating the natural law, the heavier these penalties for violating it become. Provided that we don't refuse the lesson, even the dullest among us may eventually get the. They may put the clues together. They may solve the puzzle. Unfortunately, over the course of its history, a culture may have to relearn those timeless truths over and over, and of course it may refuse to learn them and be destroyed. Something like a third of all children in the United States are now born out of wedlock and are probably not going to have both a mom and a dad. Something like 70% of black children, we are approaching cultural catastrophe. We're already in a cultural catastrophe. A little while ago, I called attention, though. All of this was just by way of explaining the concept of natural consequences. Now I'm coming back to what I was saying earlier. You remember, a little while ago when we were still talking about human law, I called attention to three interesting things. You have to be careful when I hold up fingers. It's probably a good idea not to look at my fingers, because sometimes I'll say things like three interesting things. Three interesting things. I don't know what my fingers are doing. I don't know how many are there. But usually what's coming out of my mouth is correct. To three interesting things about the civil penalties, the man-made penalties for violating the human law. Do you remember what they were? First, the penalty or consequence isn't the reason the act is wrong. It only declares it's wrong and disciplines us for committing it. Second, the declaration of what is wrong not only announces what's needed for the common good, to a certain degree it also, quote-unquote, determines it. Third, the system of penalties is not perfectly efficient. Up to a certain degree of corruption in the will, the penalty discourages violation. But beyond that point, The penalty does not discourage violation and actually may provide a motive for violation. We may now ask, now that we understand what the natural law is, now we understand what natural penalties are those three things also true about the natural consequences for violating the natural law? Or are they only true of the civil consequences for violating the human law? The answer is yes. They are also true about the natural consequences for violating the natural law. Let's see how. Point one was that the penalty or consequence isn't the reason the act is wrong. It only declares it's wrong and disciplines us for committing it. You know, I'm going to use sex as an example again. The way that some parents and some moralists harp about unwanted pregnancies and sexually transmitted diseases, you would think that if only condoms worked perfectly, if only they really could do away with unwanted pregnancies and sexually transmitted diseases, then extramarital sex would be okay. As a matter of fact, I would say that's probably one reason why a lot of people think it is okay, because they imagine that these things do work perfectly. What's wrong with this picture? Is it just that condoms don't work perfectly? Well, they don't, but that's not the reason, because you could imagine a technology that did work perfectly. Well, is it that however perfect the technology, you couldn't always get people to use it? No, because you can imagine an even better technology that worked independently of their wills. Well, then, is it just that the list of bad consequences is incomplete, that we haven't listed them all, that it isn't just pregnancies and sexually transmitted diseases, but other consequences like jealousy, mistrust? We're getting closer, but you know, you could imagine, I don't know, but at least you could imagine, it has been imagined in fiction, you could imagine a system of drugs and conditioning that would even eliminate those consequences. In Huxley's Brave New World, you've read that? What makes the people of Huxley's paradise so loathsome? What is it that makes them so loathsome? It's that they don't even understand the point of sex. They don't understand what it means. They don't understand what it's all about. It's not just a matter of consequences. There's a term that is used in ethics, ethical philosophy, consequentialism, consequentialists. Consequentialists are people who think that the only thing that makes an act right or wrong is its results, its consequences. So one way to explain what I'm saying is that natural lawyers are not consequentialists. And they shouldn't be mistaken for consequentialists just because, from time to time, they do consider consequences. That doesn't make them consequentialists. That doesn't make them people who think results are the only things that matter to the right and wrong of an act. A precept like, good is to be done and pursued, and evil is to be avoided. That is a precept of the natural law, but it means more than just good consequences are to be had and enjoyed, and evil ones to be somehow got around. In fact, the most interesting thing about the consequences that things have in this world is that they serve as a sort of a pointer to something that is actually more fundamental, and that is the purposes that things have in this world. The natural linkage between sex and pregnancy, for instance, doesn't just mean that sex has the consequence of pregnancy, although obviously it does. It also declares that sex serves the purpose of procreation, of having and raising children and making families in the love and fear of God. The natural linkage between sex and the linkage between promiscuity and mistrust, let's say, isn't just a brute fact to be circumvented if we can. What it declares is that sex itself serves the purpose of spousal intimacy and should not be used to defeat that purpose. Our very bodies speak a language to other bodies by what we do with them. Different ways of disposing our parts say different things, and we ought not lie with them. Point number two, the declaration of what is wrong not only announces what's needed for the common good, I said, but also partly determines it. And you remember my explanation of how that's true of the human law and the human consequences, like you violate the traffic law and you lose your car, you pay a fine, you get a ticket. Well, is that true of the natural law too? Yes, it is. We saw earlier that the common good is only partly given in advance of the human legislator's command. Driving on the left is not in itself contrary to the common good, but it becomes so, it really does become authentically contrary to the common good in reality when he has declared it so, just because then everyone else is driving on the right. He could have declared it contrary to the common good to drive on the right, and then it would have been contrary to driving the common good, contrary to the common good to drive on the right, because everybody would have been driving on the left. Whichever way he commanded, he would have assigned penalties accordingly. Now, that doesn't mean that he was acting arbitrarily. Why? Because there was a deeper consideration that does not change. Vehicles must not collide with each other. We should have regard for the safety and well-being of our neighbors. That's why Thomas Aquinas says that even this sort of human law, where you can fill in the blanks, you can pin down the details, you can determine, quote-unquote, whether to drive on the right or the left, ultimately has its foundation in the natural law, and the natural law precept that says, have regard for the safety of your neighbors. The natural law doesn't tell you whether you should drive on the right or the left, but it tells you you better make a decision by public authority. You better pin it down. In the same way that human law not only announces, but in this sense partly determines the common good, so also, and this is what I think even more interesting, the natural law not only announces, but partly determines the common good. Why? Because God, we're speaking of God as legislator now, not the human legislator who wrote the traffic law, God, we are told, acted freely in creation. He could have created a different universe than he did. A different nature. Different in both efficient causality, what makes what happen, and final causality, what things are for what purposes. And then there would have been a different natural law with different natural consequences for violation. Now, the determinations, quote-unquote, of the human legislature find their boundaries in the natural law. Their originality is properly confined to, as I said, merely filling in the blanks. But the only limit on God's creativity is his own being, for God cannot act contrary to himself. The only limit on the possible varieties of created goodness is his own uncreated goodness, of which we actually have no conception, because our minds work according to the structures of creation. For all we know, he might have made three sexes rather than two. Or arranged for us to procreate by budding rather than by bearing and begetting. But maybe not. We don't know. For all we know, he could have made the universe more different still with other kinds of order instead of causality or purposefulness. But maybe not. Frankly, we don't know what might have been. We have no categories for thinking about it because we are among the created things. He is the uncreated one. The only categories available to us are the ones provided by creation, by nature, the ones that God has made, which is why it's so silly for people to speculate about things like whether he could have made murder good instead of evil. It's like a child asking, what does cat poopy five green mean in French? Or, if two and two made cheese, then what would monkeys equal? It has about that degree of sense. Now, I mention this only because it seems to be a real issue for human beings, and not just something philosophers like to, you know, float around in the coffee room, but because it's a real issue for people. Once a young woman in an honors class asked me, according to the natural law theory, why is it that same-sex relationships cannot promote what natural lawyers call the unitive good, the good of authentic intimacy? I explained that, according to natural lawyers, different kinds of friendship have different natures. And sexualizing a friendship doesn't necessarily help the friendship come into its own. That's good in the relationship between the husband and the wife, but sexualizing, say, the relationship of a teacher with a student doesn't necessarily make it better, or a father with a daughter doesn't necessarily make it better, does it? Or cowboy with cowboy. But at the moment, the truth of the claim isn't my point. My point, you may disagree with me or you may agree with me about that, but that isn't my point. My point is that during the course of the conversation with this young woman who was very smart, I realized that her obstacle, I don't mean her obstacle to agreeing with me, her obstacle unto understanding what natural law thinkers were getting at wasn't so much a moral disagreement as it was an ontological disagreement. A lot of you here are students. Ontology means the philosophical study of what the world is like, basic reality. It wasn't so much a moral disagreement, what's right, what's wrong, as an ontological disagreement, a disagreement about the structure of reality. In other words, it wasn't just about how we ought to live, but about how the world is put together. In our universe, water is a liquid at room temperature. The gravitational constant is just right for the existence of life, and human men and women are complementary opposites, which means both are, in a sense, incomplete. And completeness only happens when they balance each other. There is something missing in the man. What woman in this room doesn't know that? Which he only finds in the woman. There is something missing in the woman, which she finds only in the man. Men and women, therefore, are related to each other in a way that men and men are not. Now, we haven't any way to guess what other universes might be possible. This is the only one we know. Point three, the system of penalties, you remember I said, I explained how this is true of the human law, but the question was whether it's true of the natural law too, and I said it is. The system of penalties isn't perfectly efficient. Up to a certain degree of corruption in the will of the person subject to the law, a penalty discourages violation, but beyond that point it actually provides a motive to go further. Remember what the application to human law was? I said, if a driver has a certain residue of virtue, then the threat of losing his vehicle may keep him from driving without a license. But if he lacks even that residue, he may drive still faster just to keep the policeman from catching him. And in that way, the penalty was a motive for further crime. That's one of the reasons, by the way, that human law should never be too far in advance of the level of virtue which the majority of citizens have already achieved. Otherwise, the human law may actually make people worse instead of better. But once again, the question was, is that analogous with natural law? Yes, interestingly. Once again, the analogy with natural law holds good. I suppose it's obvious how this is true of the physical natural consequences of our acts, but let me give an example. For instance, consider pregnancy. You would think that the fear of getting pregnant and having nobody to help raise the child would deter unmarried people from intercourse. And among those who still have a trace of what we used to call old-fashioned chastity, it does. But those who lack that trace try to escape the natural consequence by trying to outrun the cop. But that is by using contraceptives. When the contraceptives fail, some try still harder to escape the natural consequences by leaning out the window toward the approaching cop and firing at him with a gun. That is by getting abortions. God knows I am not trying to be self-righteous. Maybe we can talk about my own moral failures sometime. But I'm just trying to explain how natural law theory views the plain moral facts of the matter. Self-righteousness is not the issue here. If I said the moon is 200,000 miles away, and you said it's really self-righteous of you to think that, there may be people who disagree. I mean, that's sort of beside the point, isn't it? You know, the interesting thing is that how far away it is? So I'm just trying to explain how natural law theory views the plain moral facts of the matter. Count on it. Count on it. If anyone ever invents a de-intoxicating pill, there will be more drunkenness in the world than before. If anyone ever invents a perfect memory pill, there will be less knowledge in the world than before. Okay? Now, so far I've been speaking only of the physical consequences of our acts, but the point that I'm making about trying to outrun the cop, about the consequence, the penalty, sometimes driving people on to further wrongdoing, becoming a motive for further wrongdoing, applies to the intellectual consequences, the noetic consequences, in one old-fashioned word, the consequences in the intellect, in the mind itself, too. I'm talking about guilty knowledge. Abortionists write about their nightmares. Did you know that? They don't always just go around denying that they have them. People who have been complicitous in abortions tend to feel terrible. The suffering can be very great. You would think, just like the fear of the physical consequence of pregnancy deterring from promiscuous sex, you would think that the terror of it all would deter people from the practice of abortion. Among some people it does. But those who will not accept conscience as a teacher must later face conscience as an accuser. And in this way, yes, it does urge them to further wrong. Here is a true story that illustrates the point. I spoke with a counselor. A working woman told her counselor, "I couldn't be a good parent." Then she amended the remark to, "I don't deserve to have any children." And then still later in the conversation, she amended that remark to, If it hadn't been for my last abortion, I don't think I'd be pregnant now. We don't need a soothsayer to read the writing on that wall. When she says she couldn't be a good mother, what she means is that good mothers don't kill their children. That's why she thinks she couldn't be a good mother. Do you see what's happening here? She keeps getting pregnant to replace the children that she's killed, but she keeps having abortions to punish herself for having killed them. With each abortion, the cams of guilty knowledge make another revolution, setting her up to have another one. She can never stop until she admits what's going on. What are we to conclude from all of this? That Thomas Aquinas is right when he describes law as a kind of discipline, a discipline that compels us, that drives us on, through fear of punishment. He's right about the human law, and yes, he's right about the natural law. But I think something further must be said. Whether the law compels us to obedience or drives us on to further violation, and that depends on the condition of our hearts. Thank you.
So the floor is open for questions.
Hi. You said earlier in your speech that everyone knows that mocking God is wrong, and I was wondering if you had a little bit more of a concrete definition of what it means to mock God, because if you were to say that God could have been created, is that for example a good example of mocking God?
No, I mean speaking contemptuously. Okay? Now, underlying this, of course, is an assumption that I make. Many people don't make this assumption. There are even some natural law thinkers who deny this next thing that I'm about to say, but I think it's true. And I think Thomas Aquinas agreed with me, too. I think that in a certain sense there are no true atheists. That I used to be an atheist. But in retrospect, I wasn't in ignorance about the reality of God. I think what I was doing was holding my awareness of him down. For one thing, I was very angry with him, and you can't be angry with somebody who can't exist, right? It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Nietzsche, the very guy who originated the slogan "God is dead," also spoke of his of a sort of an overwhelming gratitude that came over him sometimes, a gratitude for existence, and it's a very funny thing. Gratitude is an attitudinal, it's a relational attitude. You know, you can be unhappy, that doesn't imply a relationship to somebody else. But gratitude is always to somebody. Who the heck was he grateful to? You know, if we're going to be angry, we're going to be grateful. I think that we really do know that there is a God. And when we speak in utter contempt, I think at rock bottom, deep down, underneath all of the layers of denial, I think we know we're doing wrong.
Another question.
I'm interested in this, your theory, natural consequences of violating natural law.
Could you be just a little louder? I'm a little hard of hearing.
I'm interested to follow up a little bit more closely on this idea that there are natural consequences of violating the natural law. Because it seems to me to be the case that if that were in fact true, then shame would play a much more important role than it does. And as it also appears to me now, shame seems to be an abating concern in society.
Okay, I think that's a very good question. If there are natural consequences to violating the natural law, and if these natural consequences, this was a silent premise in your question, but I think that you were assuming it, and if these natural consequences include epistemological consequences, consequences for the intellect, then why isn't there more shame? Well, shame or remorse, I would say that when you have guilty knowledge, I want to distinguish between the state of your knowledge and the state of your feelings. When you have guilty knowledge, something that sometimes happens but doesn't necessarily happen is that you feel bad. The reason I say it doesn't always happen is simple experience. Which of us in this room has never had the experience that you did something wrong and you didn't feel bad about it? I bet we've all had that experience sometime. You did something wrong, you knew it was wrong, and you didn't feel bad. And yet maybe you knew at some level that you ought to feel bad. Maybe you even felt bad about not feeling bad. Well, I think that that's pretty good evidence that even though you may not have had bad guilty feelings, which may be what you mean by shame, you did have guilty knowledge. I think that when it comes to the foundational principles, the basics, the things that you can't not know, because we can't not know them, we also at some deep level can't not know when we violated them. And so I think guilty knowledge is inevitable. I do not claim that shame, meaning guilty feelings, are inevitable. Now, that raises an interesting question. If guilty feelings do not always follow, result from guilty knowledge, are there other things that are more easily detectable that follow from guilty knowledge? Yes, I think there are. For instance, the urge to confess. Sometimes people look at the Jerry Springer show, for instance, and they think those people have no shame. I would say that telling everybody in the world every sordid detail of what you've done is not an evidence of lack of shame. It's an evidence of shame. This is not something that normal people do when they're not tormented by their deeds. And you notice that what these people are doing is compulsively telling you every detail of what they did, except that it was wrong. See, you have a confessional urge, but you're not able to satisfy it properly, correctly, because you refuse to repent. And so you have all these artificial substitutes for confession, like that. In the same way, there can be substitutes for the urge to atone. Instead of trying to make up, you pay price after price, pain after pain, except the one price demanded, which is a broken and contrite heart. You know? There are other consequences like this too, and I think they are detectable. But shame, in the sense of remorse, feeling bad, no, it doesn't always happen. All of us, from time to time, probably don't feel bad. And there are some people who never feel bad, but that's different than saying that they don't know.
You may, yeah.
Granted, I think that may be true in peripheral issues, but to use the issue that you seem to be interested in pushing, how can that be true of the abortion issue?
Oh, it can be true of the abortion issue very obviously. There are many psychologists who will say, on the basis of obsolete research, that there is no such thing as post-abortion trauma. Better research is now being done, and the reports are rolling in and have been published in peer-reviewed journals. A lot of it has been published by the Elliott Institute. You can look up a lot of this stuff online. And is showing that the psychological consequences are very terrible. Substance abuse rises sharply after abortions. Even after controlling for psychological stability and this and that and the other, even after all the control variables, substance abuse rises. Divorce rises. Suicide rises. Health gets worse. All these kinds of things happen. Why is that happening? Why is that happening? Because there's something going on inside. Now that's statistical evidence, but having been married to a woman who for 12 years was a crisis pregnancy counselor, I also have a lot of anecdotal evidence, and I gave you one example of this a few minutes ago. The woman who was talking about why she couldn't have another child. Another example of that would be this is a true story, and I'll be mentioning it in my talk tonight. A woman who had a second abortion. She didn't come in to the counseling center after her first abortion, but she did come in after the second one. In the course of counseling, she was asked, well, why did you have your first abortion? She said, because while I was pregnant, I discovered that my husband had been unfaithful to me. I was mortified. I was humiliated. I was traumatized. And so to get back at him, because he wanted the baby, I killed it. Well, okay, but she didn't come in for counseling then. Why did she come in for counseling? Why did she have the second abortion? Now, you might think that she'd say, I was still mad at my husband. No, that wasn't the reason she gave. She said, I wanted to hate myself more for what I did to the first baby. Now, except by the sort of phenomenon, the sort of explanation that I was giving earlier, how can you explain that? She refused to repent, okay, and throw herself in the mercy of God, by which means she might have been freed of her guilt. Instead, she refused to repent, and so that guilt was still driving her. She knew there was a price to be paid. This is the urge for atonement. Even the remorse that this woman did feel was not enough. She felt like it's not enough of a price to pay. I have to feel even worse. The only way that she could think of to feel even worse was to repeat the thing that was making her feel so bad in the first place. The abortion was a punishment to herself because she knew that her remorse would double. And it did. So, yeah, I think the evidence is overwhelming that this is tearing women to shreds. And those who speak in the name of compassion and say, for the sake of women, this is a feminist issue, don't love women.
Further questions?
This question presupposes that Christianity's truth claims are true. What place does natural law have today? And that you said hearts must be prepared to accept the natural law's rationale before anyone will. So should...
Who said that? You said
weren't those the closing lines of your talk? Something along those lines, like the heart...
No, I said... What I said was that whether... this isn't a preempt your question. I'm going to give the mic back to you in a second. But just by way of clarification, what I said that whether the natural consequences for violating the natural law motivate us not to violate it or instead drive us on to further disobedience depends on the condition of our hearts.
Okay,
I didn't say anything about what the relationship of that might be or might not be to Christianity.
Okay. I was just presupposing, though, that you would need that sort of heart change that comes along with relationship with Jesus Christ. That's what I said. This presupposes that, and I'm assuming that we both agree that that in order to change the heart, you would sort of need that. I mean, you're not going to change a heart from other approaches. But if I could finish the question I was going to ask, if it's true that your heart sort of has to be in the right posture, then it seems that natural law would have no impact save the influence of the gospel. Should it be presented, so should it therefore be presented in conjunction with the gospel, or does it have much effect standing on its own?
I understand where you're going. It's an interesting question. Now, I'm not going to give an answer that will fully satisfy you, and here's why. Since I'm, on the one hand, I'm obviously representing Christian intellectual life and trying to provide an example of this. But on the other hand, I'm speaking in a general forum. This is at a university. I'm speaking to believers and non-believers. And that's what I would call an in-house question. You know, how can we who share my faith and your faith, apparently, speak to non-believers? Well, this is an audience of believers as well as non-believers. And, you know, that doesn't quite feel right to me to be talking about that. That's something I would speak about in a Christian setting, just like I would expect atheists in their atheist setting to say, how can we convince those Christians that they're crazy? But insofar as you're
Christians
saying...
Christians would want to hear that.
Yeah. Insofar as you're asking, though, about what conversion has to do with receptivity to the claims of the natural law, that is something I think it's entirely legitimate for me to address here. Now, I do believe that it makes an enormous difference. But what kind of difference does it make? Does it mean that you don't have a conscience before you're a Christian? Obviously not. You know, and I've been atheist as well as Christian, and there may be atheists in the room, and you know you have a conscience. You know you have a conscience. What are some of the things that happen? Hey, let me tell you a story. There was a young man once who came to my office. Now, usually at the beginning of every semester, I think it's just a matter of intellectual honesty. People ought to know where I'm coming from. I don't like to poison the well. I don't like to play bait and switch or to trick them. And if I was a Marxist, I would tell my students, okay, I'm a Marxist. You need to know that about me. If you want to scram, don't want to be taught by Marxists, you can go. If you're going to stay in, you know, obviously my perspective is shaped by Marxism, and you can disagree with me, but this is where I'm coming from. Well, so I tell them where I'm coming from, and I'm a Christian. I'll admit that to them. This semester, I forgot to do that on the first day, and I thought, well, it would seem artificial and forced if I do it on a subsequent day. I'll just let that slide, and that was fine. So I'd been teaching Aristotle, as I always do, the Nicomachean Ethics and Introduction to Ethics and Political Theory. And he's talking about virtue and so forth. And hadn't said a word about God, hadn't used the word sin, hadn't even used the expression moral law. guilt, nothing like this, because those weren't the terms that Aristotle was using, and I was explaining to him. Student came to my door. He was an older student. He was about 35, returning student. He'd been out of school for a while. Comes to my office door, and he says, "No, this was not a Christian, sir. This is the kind that, by I think, your assumptions, he should not have existed." Okay? Because his conscience was already enlivened, but he was not a person of faith. And he said, "Professor," he was a very dramatic guy, and I'm not making this up. He says, "Professor, I got to talk to you." I said, "Well, okay, what do you got to talk to me about?" He says, "You're scaring me." And I said, "How am I scaring you?" He said, "Well, it's really not you. It's this guy Aristotle." And I said, "How's Aristotle scaring you?" And finally, he got to the point. He said, "Well, in this book of his, he keeps talking about virtue, and it's making me realize that I haven't led a virtuous life, and I'm scared." And then he held out his hand and he said, "See, I'm shaking." And sure enough, now maybe it was DTs, I don't know. But I believed him. I believed him that he was in fact scared. Now, Christians have a term for this: conviction of sin. It's not a term which is proper to natural law theory. It comes at the intersection between natural law theory and Christian theology. And I thought I knew what was happening to him. But it was interesting that, in my view, as a Christian, I believed that God was making use of something that was implanted in his natural design, conscience, in order to stir him up to a receptivity to the question of, what do I do with this now? No, I don't think that a person has no receptivity to the claims of natural law unless he's already a Christian. And I think the fact that the natural law is already built into the design of the human intellect may, on the contrary, make him receptive to asking the questions about the Christian faith.
Another question. Yes.
I may have missed this, but are you asserting that there's for some transgressions, I suppose, against natural law, that the only, like you gave examples of guilt.
Yeah.
Now, are those like, I mean, is there anything, can that be the only consequence for some natural laws being broken? I ask this because, I say, you may have said something I just may have missed as like an additional consequence, but you know, throughout history, you cite psychology a lot, and you know there are times when guilt can be more or less irrational.
Oh, there is. Okay. At first, I thought you were asking a different question. If the question is there such a thing as irrational guilt? There is. This is a neurotic condition that needs to be addressed. And I don't use the mere fact that somebody feels guilty as proof that they have violated the natural law. But I do think that the flip side holds, that if you have violated one of the foundational principles of the natural law, you have guilty knowledge at some level. I don't claim that it will lead to remorse, but I do claim that it produces other symptomology which can be detected. Now, at first, I thought you were going to go somewhere different and say, are there any violations of natural law that produce only one natural consequence, guilty knowledge, and no other natural consequences? Was I wrong? Were you going there?
I mean, you said the abortion thing, for example, and I thought that, you know, you used psychology and guilt, and I was under the impression, maybe I was wrong, that was your sole main justification as to displaying why that is inherently wrong.
No, I wasn't talking about why it's wrong. The reason that it's wrong is that life is a great good, that there is a dignity and sacredness to life, that we all do intuitively grasp, if intuition is the right word, that it is a grave transgression to deliberately take innocent human life. I think that this is self-evident to us. I think that we all do know it, that the knowledge is what philosophers call per se nota. It is known in itself. It isn't known because it's proven by other considerations, but we all, in fact, really do know it. Now, the only question is, I'm just saying, does this knowledge when we have the knowledge that we have violated this norm, do things happen to us? The answer is yes. Is it wrong only because the bad things happen to us? No, it would be wrong if nothing happened. Remember the stuff that I was talking about, Huxley's Brave New World and de-intoxicating pills and all that? That was the point. If you could come up with a magic anti-guilt pill and you never felt bad, and your guilty knowledge was nullified and you were in a sort of a moral stupor, everything seems okay to me. Would that make the act okay? No, of course not. Good question.
Jay, let me use quickly my moderator's prerogative and also because of the guilty knowledge of having my constitutional law class here and ask you, you've spoken first about the level of the legislator making ordinary legislation such as traffic laws. You've spoken also about the level of natural law.
Right.
But it seems to me that in America, at least, our constitutionalism is somewhere between those two.
Yes, I think you're right.
And I'm wondering if that's so, and what are the consequences of that? Or what are the natural consequences, I suppose, in a constitution or to a constitutional system if natural law is violated?
Good question. The question of whether there is a natural law is a different question from the question of whether judges are the people who get to announce what the natural law is. Some people make the mistake of thinking that if there is a natural law, then you must be a runaway judicial activist and say, well, then the judge gets to overrule anything that the legislature has done by just saying, the natural law says. No. If you believe in the natural law, then you should be saying, okay, our system of man-made laws should be in support of the natural law. It should be upholding it. It should not be in violation of it. Now, what is the best distribution of legal responsibilities to see to it that comes about? My own view is that the best distribution is that lawmakers make laws and consider what the natural law is in the making of these laws. That judges, by and large, defer to legislators, that it is the exception and not the rule that they challenge these laws, that the judge's own knowledge of the natural law comes into play primarily not to overturn a law, but to figure out what it means. Now, I'll give you an example. The 1932 Restatement of Contracts, this isn't an original example. This example was first offered by a guy named Charlie Rice, who was a teacher of natural law. He taught at Notre Dame University. The 1932 Restatement of Contracts said that it gave a definition of the circumstances under which a contract is enforceable. And I'm going to paraphrase. What it said, in effect, was that a contract is enforceable if and only if violation of the contract would cause injustice. Do you see the catch? You can't apply that definition unless you know what injustice is. So even if you say, I'm not going to be an activist, I'm going to be completely deferential to the legislature, and the legislature has said something, let us say, like that, you still have to make use of your knowledge of the natural law, not in order to decide whether you're going to listen to the legislature, but in order to know how to listen to the legislature. Even if your only intention is to do what the legislature says, you're still going to have to consider the natural law to figure out what the heck the legislature is talking about. Now, are there any circumstances whatsoever where I would say that a judge can simply overturn, before we were talking about interpretation and deference, where I would say that a judge can simply overturn the law that he considers contrary to the natural law? The only one case. If we're talking about the secondary, the more detailed precepts of the natural law, there is no reason to think that a judge understands that better than a legislator. Okay? Or in fact, there is plenty of reason to think that the legislators are in a better position to research this and to think about it than the judges are, and so judges ought to defer. But what if you're talking about one of the basic fundamental principles? Thou shalt not deliberately take innocent human life is not something that it takes moral expertise to know about it. This is one of those things you can't not know. The judges know this as well as the legislators. Now the legislature says, round up all the Jews and kill them. They don't have to have committed crimes. Round them all up. Kill them. Okay? This is directly a violation of the precept that forbids the deliberate taking of innocent human life. And in a case like that, But it would have to be that radical. Yes, I think that then a judge can say, that law is not going to be enforced in this court. Now, if you want to impeach me, you can. If you want to execute me, you can. But I am laying myself on the railroad tracks.
So as a follow-up then, very quickly, if in a without Roe v. Wade, we're in 1970 or 71, and states are beginning to pass laws that are permissive of abortion, then you would allow a legislator, you would allow a judge to strike down a law that permitted abortion because that would have permitted the taking of innocent human life.
Yeah, I would have, as a matter of fact. Even some natural law people have disagreements about this, because the question is, are we talking about one of the general principles, or are we talking about one of the remote implications? I think that this is one of the things that you can't not know. You can't not know the wrong of deliberately taking innocent human life. Consider the pyrotechnics that you have to go through to convince yourself that you're not doing it if you're having an abortion. People say, well, you know, I wasn't deliberate. I didn't have a choice. Or they say, as one feminist lawyer said, that, you know, she granted that it's wrong to deliberately take innocent human life and that this was human life, but she said the fetus isn't innocent. It has aggressively invaded the woman's womb and made her pregnant. Her own language. She has quite a discussion of how the fetus makes her pregnant against her will, and she actually compares the unborn baby to a rapist. And I think that that's crazy. And I think the craziness of it is patently obvious. These are the sorts of things that it would be very difficult to get ordinary women to believe, but judges can sometimes talk themselves into all sorts of things.
Great. Another question from the floor.
Is there a difference between civil disobedience and then a judge acting out its constitutional job? And wouldn't the judge be acting more in civil disobedience than his constitutional?
Yeah, there's a disagreement about this. Justice Scalia disagrees with me about this, for instance. Justice Scalia agrees with me that there is a natural law. He's also a legal positivist. He believes that because he took an oath to uphold the law, he takes that as meaning to uphold the positive law. And therefore, what he would have to do if he were faced with the necessity of giving judicial force to a legislative enactment that was in violation of the natural law, he might resign. Okay, but he couldn't strike it down. Now, I think it is under some constitutional systems, and it depends on what constitutional system you're talking about, to refuse to, for instance, give any judicial effect to, let's say, a law rounding up all the Jews and putting them in concentration camps would be, it would depend. It would depend on what you made an oath to, etc. It would be an act of, what your Constitution authorizes under some judicial systems, that would be an act of judicial civil disobedience. Under others, it wouldn't. There are some judicial systems that explicitly recognize a role for natural law. But yes, it could be. And the natural law tradition has acknowledged some very carefully delimited place for judicial, for civil disobedience.
There's some questions in the back, I noticed.
In your opinion, do you feel that breaking, like if someone basically breaks the natural law, do you feel that the penalty of natural law is justified by that?
If you violate the natural law, is the penalty justified? Yes.
For example, murder, and like the gentleman said, I may have zoned out on it for a second trying to catch up with what you're saying, but like implicitly, intrinsically, murder is wrong, naturally.
Yeah, and what are some of the consequences? Well, guilty knowledge can be a consequence.
Uh-huh.
You know, if you murder people, nobody's going to trust you. Those who live by knives die by knives. Are these rational consequences? Do they make sense as a penalty for the deed? They do make sense, and I think that they are actually merciful, because they may in the end, after we've made ourselves just as stupid and wicked as we can, we may finally come to our senses, because this is just so devastating to us.
Okay, just one more thing. For lack of argument, like say it's a perfect crime, you kill somebody, nobody knows.
Right.
Hypothetically speaking, nobody else sees it. You, person, God. The only thing you have is a guilty conscience. Do you believe that is necessarily...
Oh, I think that, yeah, okay. Yeah. Then the question is about this guy. You committed the perfect crime. Nobody knows that you did it. You got away with it, as the world reckons getting away with it. You've got a guilty conscience, but nothing else.
Someone lost their life.
Somebody lost their life. Sure. Now, what's the question then? Oh! Well, I think in a sense it is too little. We shouldn't say people are already suffering the penalty of guilty conscience. We shouldn't put them in jail too. No, I think that we need to administer civil penalties also, absolutely, for the protection of the physical safety and the moral order of society. I think that we have to do that. I understand your question now, sir. Thank you.
All right. I just got one quick question. I came late, so I didn't hear you define natural law. My question
is make it a more interesting question.
Right. So my question is: does natural law ever change? Let me just give an example. In most part of the human history, or in most part of the world. Men are allowed to have more than one wives. I mean, that's just a fact.
Sure. That is a fact.
And so now, I mean, when our civilization advanced, now, you know, we are all allowed, I mean, men are allowed only to have one wife.
Yeah.
So does that mean the natural change?
No. The natural law is not defined by universal consensus. It is no accident that there is a substantial cross-cultural consensus on many of the points of the natural law. The reason for that is that there is some deep knowledge, as I've been talking about. But on the other hand, I don't use the mere presence or absence of consensus as proving that something is in the natural law, because there's a distorting factor too, the universal desire to evade it. Now, it is true that as to the fundament, you're not going to find a culture that doesn't recognize the wrong of deliberately taking innocent human life, a basic like that. Something like how many wives can you have? This is one of the more detailed precepts of the natural law. How well a particular culture understands these things, or how well a particular individual understands these things, can vary. I wouldn't claim that monogamy is one of the things that you can't not know. Okay? I would say that the wrong of unfaithfulness to your spouse is. I wouldn't say that the wrong of monogamy is. In cases like this, it is possible, through good moral teaching, for the knowledge of the goodness of monogamy to spread. And interestingly enough, that is happening, despite the fact that, as you rightly point out, polygamy has been the norm in most societies throughout most of human history. The current trend all across the world, cross-culturally, including in formerly polygamous societies, the only partial exceptions are in the West, where it seems that it's not a sweep toward polygamy so much as it is a decay of confidence in monogamy. But in most of the world, the trend is toward monogamy now. Why is that? Not because of any changes in human nature, so that we could speak of a change in the natural law, but because of a greater recognition of some things that have been true in the design of human nature all along. That monogamy is better for the children. Monogamy is better for the society, even, in that, consider, if some men are having lots of wives, and if the ratio between the sexes is roughly 50-50, who's going to be getting all, you know, that means that some men are going to be getting a lot of wives, and others are going to be getting no wives. That doesn't seem right. Consider further, who's going to be getting all those wives? It'll be the wealthy, won't it? It'll be those who are already powerful. And the poor won't be marrying. So this exacerbates social tension. Polygamy also lends itself to an authoritarian personality structure. Okay? Because you've got this one man lording over all these women. And the tendency in such a relationship is for this not to be on terms of the equal dignity of the spouses and on the basis of intimacy, but it's going to be more like a property relationship. The recognition that these are real goods that can be brought about only in a monogamous relationship and that are lost in a polygamous relationship is spreading throughout most of the world. I don't call that a change in the natural law. I call that an increasing awareness of one of the more detailed aspects of the natural law that is not one of the things that you can't not know.
A couple more questions, then we'll set you free.
Well, you answered partially the question I was going to ask, but mine's framed slightly differently.
Uh-huh.
If you begin teaching natural law with the premise that we're hardwired for it, our human nature just sort of has an instinct for it.
Mm-hmm. Which I don't, but go ahead.
Well, you did mention that.
No, I didn't.
We're born with it, didn't you? I thought. How do you explain historical progression on topics like torture, equality of women, things like that, where obviously Christian nations thought torture was okay in the Middle Ages? Then we didn't, and now looks like it's a question on the table again.
Yeah. Okay. It's a good and it's a legitimate question. Now, in order to answer it, though, I have to correct one misunderstanding. I didn't speak of hardwiring. There is a common misconception that if you believe in natural law, you believe in innate moral knowledge. Innate moral knowledge would mean, literally, that when the child pops out of the womb, he already knows everything, right? We know that this is not the case. The child doesn't have any conceptual knowledge at all yet. What he has is the makings for conceptual knowledge, and the mind that is there, ready for the making, does have some structure. It does have some structure so that, well, for instance, the mind is not born knowing that 2 + 2 = 4, but it is structured in such a way that the child can learn to recognize this. He can learn to recognize that it isn't true just because mommy and daddy told him, but because 2 + 2 really does equal 4, and every normal human being does in fact learn it. Okay? The same is true with the moral knowledge. We call such knowledge not innate, but rather underived. Underived. Okay? Every normal human being is aware of certain truths. He realizes that they are true in themselves. His mom and dad may have told them to him, but it's not just because his mom and dad told them that that he believes in them. On the other hand, they weren't innate. He wasn't born with them. Is there any hardwiring at all? He was given the kind of mind that is able to recognize, yeah, sure, there is. He was given the kind of mind that is able to recognize that this is true for itself. But was he hardwired with the knowledge itself? No. No. He was programmed to be able to recognize this later on when his mind came to maturity. He was not programmed with the knowledge already in his memory banks. Okay? Now, we need to make a further distinction between the things that you can't not know and the things that it is possible to be in ignorance of. In the things that it's possible to be in ignorance of, which covers an awful lot of things. The example a few minutes ago was, can you have one wife or four? Okay? About the things that it is possible to be in ignorance of, there's going to have to be a lot of argument, a lot of disagreement. People are going to have to pay prices for doing things that aren't in accord with their nature. They figure out this isn't, this just isn't working. And cultures can go downhill or they can go uphill. And there's no guarantee either of progress or of degradation. As to the things that you can't not know, even there, the picture is not as static as you think, because the fact that you know something doesn't mean that you're going to admit to yourself that you know it. You can tell yourself that you don't know what you really do. And I think that is the problem with our own culture. There are many things that we know better than, but we keep telling ourselves we don't know better. You know, in most times and places, if you say to somebody, you know, you're really ignorant, you don't know anything, people will be insulted. But in our age, people pride themselves on their ignorance. They say, you know, everything is shades of gray about morality, and it's so hard to figure out what's right and wrong, and I'm doing the best that I can, and I just don't know. If you tell the guy, you know, I think you know more than you're letting on, he's insulted. He's insulted because you say he's not ignorant. Well, that's very interesting, and I think that... but I think that we're not as ignorant as we think. So even there can be a kind of a... there can either be progress or degradation in our honesty with ourselves and whether we're going to acknowledge to ourselves some of the things that deep down we do know. And this can be pretty deep. Even for instance, cannibal tribes. People say, well, these people don't know that it's wrong to deliberately take innocent human life. Look, they're eating some of those humans in the other tribe. Yeah, but they think the people in the other tribe aren't human. They actually do acknowledge that it's wrong to deliberately take innocent human life. More than that, they also engage in elaborate expiatory rituals before they go on a raid. Why would you engage in a ritual to expiate your guilt unless deep down you had some awareness that you aren't allowing to float into present awareness? That, yeah, in fact, I am deliberately taking innocent human life. I think that's interesting.
Well, we have to break for dinner, but I want to and then welcome you back at 7 o'clock in Nicholson Hall Auditorium for Professor Budziszewski's final talk here. I want to thank you all for coming and ask you to thank Dr. Budziszewski for being so helpful.